Good morning. Please be seated. This is case number 58181, Wilmington versus Carvallo et al. If counsel is ready to proceed, please do so. If you wish to reserve any time, please state how much time you wish to reserve.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Daniel Ryan. I represent the appellant, Vicki Wilmington, in this matter. And at this time, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Forgery. Two admitted acts of forgery to procure highly sensitive health information. Withholding of records and information that RMCM agreed to disclose via a contract. These actions constitute breach of contract, fraud, and other intentional torts, forming damages independent from the prior action, the prior personal injury action.
What are the damages?
The damages, the heart of the damages in this case are emotional distress and all of the things that combine with emotional distress that the Supreme Court has recognized, including humiliation, embarrassment, anxiety, and this emotional distress.
Wasn't she obligated to produce these medical records to maintain her suit?
In a sense, she was obligated to produce these records in the sense that discovery of relevant information is required when you're pursuing a lawsuit. Also, as the appellee will bring up, I'm sure, is that she started a personal injury suit, thereby, according to them, waiving their privacy rights. Now, the problem with the first contention is that while you do produce records, when you're
pursuing... You also put your medical condition into issue.
That's true. You do put that into issue. Now, when the discovery rules provide for certain ways for a defendant to get information, this is the first part of two parts of my argument. First, the rules provide that you can get that information through a request for production. And if that information is not provided, you can get it through a motion to compel. There is no rule requiring that an authorization be used. Furthermore, this authorization that was used in this case provided specific contractual terms within the same. So RMCM...
What's the consideration for the contract?
The consideration for the contract on the plaintiff's behalf is, all right, I'm allowing you to access sensitive health information.
You have an obligation to produce that. Is that illusory?
That is correct. You have an obligation to produce that information. However, you do not have an obligation to allow direct access to those records. You do not.
Yeah, and once you do that, why all of a sudden when the expiration date on the authorization comes and goes, it becomes an issue that merits damages?
Well, when you provide that information, you're providing it for, first of all, as I said, you're allowing direct access to it. Second, you're providing it for a limited scope of time. You're providing it for under certain conditions. You're providing it under certain contractual conditions. And the opposing counsel, in that case, does not have free rein to simply acquire that information whenever they see fit. They also have to abide by the contractual conditions found in that authorization. One, providing the request, forwarding the request to plaintiff's counsel in that action, and two, providing any records that were gathered at that time. RMCM failed to do both. Now, it's the nature, what makes this case unique, and what makes this case stand out, and I believe that the Supreme Court should take particular notice of it, is the conduct that is going on in this case. It's not a case where simply a defense counsel receives a protected health information authorization form, agrees to the conditions, and thereby goes and gets the health information after the expiration date. Or it's not even simply a case where they get the information without the form itself. It's
in that case, would there be a basis for damages?
In that case, well, I will submit to you that the case law that is in existence right now would say no, there is no basis for damages in a situation like that.
Might be sanctionable.
Might be sanctionable. Might be some form of punishment involved in that form, but the act of taking a document involving this type of information and then forging it in two different ways, one, forging the date it was signed, and then forging the expiration date of the same, and then using it at that point, that is the specific nature of the conduct that's at issue here. That is what makes it formidable as an independent tort or torts.
But doesn't the fact that there are sanctions available, including contempt, referral to the State Bar of Nevada and all kinds of other available sanctions, operate to prevent that type of
There might be those sanctions available, but those sanctions aren't going to address the damages, the independent damages that Ms. Wolverton experienced as a result of this conduct.
That's why the argument is kind of circular. But what are the damages?
The damages are
the emotional distress. If at one period of time she was obligated to provide these records, the counsel was entitled to get the records, and then after an expiration date on a authorization, all of a sudden she's incurred emotional distress because they got the records.
Right. Well, I don't believe it's circular because it's. Sanctions by the State Bar or any type of sanctions like that are not going to address the harm that she's experienced. And it's
what is the harm? That's where I'm just.
I know.
And I know it's difficult to articulate.
It's very difficult, and it's the harm of knowing that somebody has taken a document that you've executed and changed your own writing. It's the harm of somebody getting sensitive health information from you and not providing it to you under those contractual terms. It's the harm of being at a trial and the defense counsel is getting up, misrepresenting your health history, and it's the anxiety, it's the feeling of powerlessness, it's the feeling of helplessness that you're experiencing while records are the absence of or being alleged against you, and you have to sit there and experience that. It's an invasion of a privacy interest. It is an invasion. You know, fine, you have to put forth the records. I submit, you do have to put forth the records. But when you take that document and the plaintiff in that case grants a limited scope for a limited amount of time under certain conditions, and the acts that were perpetrated are of such a grievous nature that they cause independent and distinct damages.
If it weren't something you just said brings us back to the very point in this case that needs to be resolved.
Okay.
If the use of these records during the trial below was improper, wasn't that addressed on appeal in that particular case? And why wouldn't that be a preclusion issue here?
Well, the issue that was addressed in that case was whether she was prejudiced in that underlying action. The issue in that case was not whether she experienced damages as a result of that action. The issue in that case was whether the case should be overturned because of that conduct. The issue in this case is whether the conduct that was perpetrated results in an independent damage aside from what went on in the underlying lawsuit and aside from the facts and circumstances and the arguments contained in the prior lawsuit. And I urge that because of the circumstances that independent torts should be recognized. And I will also concede that this conduct that we're presented with is unprecedented. I've spoken of cases where they get records without an authorization or they go past the expiration date, but you won't find a case where this type of conduct has been perpetrated before.
In the other case, how did they determine how this incident occurred, its alteration of the date and all like that? Was there some sort of evidentiary hearing or in the underlying case?
In the underlying case, there was an issue where counsel for RMCM came up and gave opening statements. And Mr. Christensen was going and checking through to see if this gap ever happened. He was going through the records thoroughly. He came across, he would be better to testify to this than me, but from what my understanding from speaking with him is, once the issue came up, he started going through the records, he compared the authorizations that were in the file, and at that time he noticed that that RMCM had forged the document and that this had happened.
So it wasn't discovered until during the trial?
It wasn't discovered until during the trial. Ms. Wolverton was informed of it, and, you know, this is not in the briefs, but she has experienced significant emotional distress as a result of this. She's appalled. She's disgusted that this type of conduct can go forward, and she's...
So there's never been a... Because it was in the middle of the trial, I never found out how the alteration occurred, who did it, when they did it, and all that.
There's no motion in the trial to preclude use of these documents or make particular arguments based on the...
There was an argument, and it is in the appendices, where Mr. Christensen was arguing that he should be able to put in the records and make some form of instruction to the jury. I know that he argued to at least put in the records to remedy the effect, and the judge in the lower court determined, no, you cannot put in the records, and they cannot argue any gap in treatment, but they had already argued it. They had already argued it in opening statements, and they had already argued it or elicited such testimony or guided such testimony in such a way.
There was no motion to strike that?
At that time, I don't believe so. So, and, you know, it's the situation, especially in the privacy interests that were invaded, I'd ask the court to please recognize the Colorado case that I cited in a footnote in my opening brief, where the Colorado Appellate Court did recognize, I will concede that the circumstances were not identical to this, but the premise was the same. It was a misappropriation of medical records, and it was medical records gathered outside of the scope of the authorization granted by the person giving the authorization. And I believe that that case and the premise and the rationale behind it should help guide the court in its decision here today.
Can I touch just one about the invasion of privacy claim?
Sure.
There's an issue whether that was properly preserved in the district court.
Correct.
And looking at the pleas in the second amended complaint, you have a reference to an intrusion upon the seclusion of Ms. Wolverton. Is this your position that's sufficient to plead under notice of pleading invasion of privacy?
Correct. It is, and I believe that the lower court dismissed this action because it wasn't ripe, and it also dismissed the action on 12B6 grounds, not 56 grounds, so where they look strictly at the pleadings. Also, as I mentioned in the reply brief, it may not have been stated as a specific cause of action. However, I do believe that the language was indeed sufficient under the notice pleading standards to make that claim.
Thank you.
I have a quick question. I have 2 minutes, 45 seconds left. Is that my rebuttal time?
I'm going to give you a full 3 minutes.
Okay. Thank you.
Hey, please, the court. I'm Joe Guerin, and I represent the respondents in this case. It's an interesting case. I appreciate the court's questions. To counsel, and appreciate his arguments. The first thing I'd like to touch on in argument has to do with the question of damages. And this is important because the case has evolved, and I think what we're looking at is whether Judge Denton's dismissal was sound. In the appendix, volume 3, page 000206, in opposition to our motion to dismiss, the plaintiff identifies damages, quote, plaintiff has a discrete identifiable harm. She was deprived of her ability to seek damages for the treatment reflected in the withheld records, as well as significant litigation costs.
But isn't the damages more of a Rule 56 motion than a motion to dismiss? I mean, it seems to me that's a factual issue, you know, whether she sustained any damages and whether they're legally recognizable for this type of conduct.
I agree. However, for purposes of the motion to dismiss, they have to at least make the allegation of damage and show that there's a damage that can be compensated. Mm-hmm. And in identifying that, the statement of counsel was that she was deprived of her ability to seek damages for treatment as well as significant litigation costs. And that's the precise issue that was considered by Judge Wall in the trial court and then on the subsequent appeal, which was rejected.
I read the order on the appeal. I know two of my colleagues were on that case on the appeal of the other one, but the order doesn't really address this issue in the entered by the Supreme Court. So was that thoroughly vetted in the other case?
There were substantial post-trial motions on this, and I think that Judge Waller, I'm not here to really address the decision he made, but the decision he made was sound. There was a question about whether the records, how the records were obtained. Counsel made argument that there was a gap in treatment. Plaintiff's counsel discovered that the records hadn't been produced, and Judge Wall said, you know what, look, you got them improperly, you should have produced them, so no one's going to talk about it. And that's a very sound way to resolve the issue.
But the counsel said that there was already reference to it in the case prior to the judge entering that ruling. What's your position on that?
Certainly Judge Wall had the opportunity at that time to address it, and there could have been a curative instruction to the jury. If it was a concern of plaintiff's counsel, just to ask the jury to disregard any argument about a gap in treatment. And Judge Wall is in the best position of anyone to deal with that because it's a case that's actively litigated in his court. The question about whether the invasion of privacy claim was properly pled, I think, is significant for this court because, again, we're looking at what Judge Denton did and if it's something that this court should affirm. And I'd like to direct the court's attention to Rule 8 and Rule 10. And Rule 8A and 8B talk about that a complaint should be simple, concise, and direct. And these are rules that everyone should comply with when they're setting forth their claims. And then if you look at Rule 10B, it mandates that separate counts, whenever separation facilitates clear presentation of the matter set forth, should also be included in the complaint. So when we filed our initial motion for more definite statement, the complaint we got didn't identify anything. It was kind of a litany of allegations with, hey, figure it out. You can try and determine what kind of motion you want to file in opposition to this. We're not going to identify our theories. Subsequently, we filed a motion for more definite statement because that's what the rules tell us to do. And the amendment that came back identified several counts, but again, it was deficient. So we filed a second motion for more definite statement. And in response, the plaintiff identified five different causes of action that they were pursuing, such as breach of contract, intentional infliction, negligence, breach of fiduciary duty, misrepresentation, and arguably a violation of HIPAA. But there's no identification of an invasion of privacy or an intrusion upon seclusion claim. So that issue couldn't have been briefed at that time. They didn't identify it. The argument wasn't made in the trial court, and so for the first time, is being presented to your honors to decide whether the claim is properly alleged.
Well, Mr. Gale, let me ask you, the motion to dismiss was granted without prejudice. It was done like 7 months before the Supreme Court entered its order. Even if we agreed with you, wouldn't he, assuming the statute of limitations isn't up, I don't know if it is or isn't, but if it's not up, couldn't they refile their lawsuit based upon the district court's ruling?
Judge, I agree that the matter was it was granted without prejudice, the motion to dismiss. Mm-hmm. And our argument is that in considering the matter de novo, the court should look at the pleadings and the argument that was directed below and understand from that that there was no invasion of privacy claim that was raised at that time in opposition to any of the motions.
Let's say there wasn't. Couldn't they sue? Let's say they entered an order today affirming. Couldn't they file a lawsuit for invasion of privacy and lay it out? And again, it may be barred by the statute of limitations, but theoretically do that. Would they be precluded from doing that?
Yeah, our position is that, yeah, the issue was actually litigated and it could have been addressed by the trial court and it wasn't raised properly or timely.
Okay.
So our position is that no. But then, Ron, it's going back to the initial question, and Your Honor, it kind of dovetails in with the next point of the argument. If we're looking at what Judge Denton did, and the question is whether the dismissal, because the underlying appeal hadn't been resolved, whether that was proper, I think that if we look at Capico and Semenza in those cases, which granted are legal malpractice cases, if we look at those, it's pretty clear that what the Supreme Court's looked for in those precedent is a resolution so that if the appeal is granted in the underlying case, then the case can come back and it ameliorates any damages. And so if we go back to what it is that they claim was the damage when this case started, that she was deprived of her ability to seek damages for treatment, then if she would have prevailed on that appeal and the Supreme Court ordered a new trial, she would have then had the opportunity to raise whatever damages she wants. So it would have ameliorated any of the damages she's claiming in this lawsuit. So,
well, she's claiming a whole lot. As counsel indicated earlier, I tried to make a determination as to what the damages were. She's claiming emotional distress damages and all kinds of additional damages. Failure to be able to seek treatment.
I appreciate that, but when pressed and asked to make the argument in the trial court, the response was that the damages were the inability to obtain treatment. And so, in essence, that's what they're challenging. So, on appeal, they're raising new arguments, which...
Counsel, the order specifically indicates the factual allegations relevant to the elimination of plaintiff's claims in this action of the subject of the appeal, and the plaintiffs cannot demonstrate damages in this action. And it says, while the appeal is pending.
Right. It's a rightness issue only.
And I agree, Your Honor. I completely agree that it was a rightness issue, and that's how Judge Dent decided it. And the question that I was trying to address was whether that dismissal was appropriate. So we agree that he was looking at the rightness issue, but then on the de novo review, we're asking that the court put an end to what is now the third piece of litigation arising out of an auto accident, in essence.
Well, and I guess the aspect here that is terribly bothersome is this allegation of forgery. How did this happen? I'd like to know.
Judge, my appreciation, and I know Mr. Carvalho, and to the extent I can vouch for him on the record, I will, is that they had a paralegal or a record clerk who was asked to follow up with records, and that clerk took it upon themselves to white out and change dates. And granted, Mr. Carvalho is the captain of the ship. He's ultimately responsible for that. He had absolutely no idea that it happened.
None of this was fleshed out in the district court?
Yeah, I guess it didn't come up until trial. So you're saying Mr. Carvalho was kind of shocked when this whole thing came up at the trial when Mr. Christensen found this alteration on the date.
Right, exactly. Dan was preparing for trial and reviewing his records and thought that they'd been produced in the ordinary course without knowing until it was raised by Mr. Christensen that there was an issue about the medical authorization. Another point that I'd like to hit on is the whole idea that there should be satellite litigation arising out of what happens in discovery in another case. And granted, there's not a lot of case law on this. But the case that I think is the closest, or perhaps the one that the court should consider, is out of Missouri. In that case, Your Honors, it involved an underlying automobile accident, and the defendants were asked if they had photographs or records, and they went out on the record or in their disclosure said, no, we don't have them. And lo and behold, 5 days before the final pretrial, the defendant's attorney says, hey, we have five pictures we never gave you. And the plaintiff later instituted an action and said, hey, you withheld these. We had significant litigation costs. It caused us other damages. And the court that looked at it, they said, you know what? This is something that is best dealt with in the trial court, because the trial court has inherent authority to control its docket and sanction the attorneys that appear in front of it. And that's, in essence, what should happen in this case. That's what Judge Wall is in the best position to do.
But, counsel, this is, I mean, the case law that you're talking about is allowing things that are independent significance, intentional torts to possibly go forward depending on the factual situation. Is it the purview of the court to just throw it out before it has an hearing, or should it have allowed it to go forward sufficiently to have an hearing and for a jury to decide?
Well, our view is that the trial court who's confronted with that issue is in the best position to determine it and try and understand what impact it's had, if any. And I think that at that time, if plaintiff thought that there was some other kind of independent damage, it should have been raised so that the court could deal with it. Because, again, trial courts have inherent authority beyond Rule 11, beyond any of the other order powers that give the trial court the power to deal with the litigants and the attorneys that appear in front of it.
Yeah, I think normally I'd agree with you. I think that's just a common sense. It's just this case is so bizarre in that it was discovered in the middle of the trial and it surprised both attorneys, you know, like that. And assuming Ms. Wilburton had a right to bring a tort action here, I don't know if she loses that right if it just kind of came up in the middle of the trial. I don't know. We'd have to look at that. As I said, the law is not clear on that. We're going to have to try and resolve that issue.
I suppose that's the last thing I'd like to touch on is whether there is an actionable tort. Is this an invasion of privacy?
Well, even beyond that, I keep going back to Judge Denton's orders in this case. And all he discussed was rightness. Okay, so why should we wander beyond that?
Well, the facts have changed. So now if that's the only argument that is going to be considered, the rightness issue has been resolved because the theory that the Supreme Court could have reversed the trial court's decision in the Water Acting case and sent the case back for a new trial, that would have resolved the damages that she was seeking in this case in the trial court. Because again, what they identify, Appendix Volume 3, page 206, is that the harm was the inability to see damages for the treatment.
Well, our consideration, shouldn't it be focused on language of the order and whether or not he made a correct determination that the factual allegations relevant to the elements of the plaintiff's claims in the action are the subject of the appeal? And plaintiff cannot demonstrate damages in the action while the appeal is pending. Isn't that what we have to address and determine whether he made the correct call on that?
Yes, that is the first question. That's the first question. But we think that the court should exercise its discretion and conduct a de novo review and consider is the actual invasion of privacy tort here.
Well, counsel, we're kind of caught in between a rock and a hard place based upon the order of Judge Denton. If we say deny the appellant's request, all we do is throw you back in the position where the district court is saying it wasn't right. They additionally say they declined to consider or rule upon all of the factual legal arguments. So it really would allow them, as Justice Gibbons indicated, if the statute hasn't run, to refile. So I guess we're really, the order and as drafted, possibly really shackles us at some points in terms of really giving a definitive determination or allowing us to, as you're requesting at this point, de novo review it to go back into things on this motion to dismiss.
This is, I think that the court, when you're deciding this, you can decide. Judge Denton was right, but beyond that, there is no invasion of privacy claim because she had a pre-existing obligation to provide
his medical information. He said it wasn't right, and he said he's not making any factual findings as to legal arguments raised in the motion. So it had nothing to do with the words described on this page, which I presume were offered by you.
Your Honor, the fact of the matter is that the case wasn't right. But regardless of what was decided after that, his decision is correct. The case wasn't ripe at that time.
And that's our concern, at that time.
Right.
And I'm not sure we can go, is there a reason we can go beyond that? Or do we have to stop right there? It was not ripe at that time, period.
With the court's indulgence, if I can. Thank you. I think that you can actually do both. You can say, it wasn't ripe at that time, but beyond that, there isn't an invasion of privacy tort here because she was obligated to provide these medical records. The fact that they were obtained, it doesn't change the fact that they should have been in the case. And based on that alone, that doesn't amount to an intrusion upon seclusion tort.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Ryan, you have 3 minutes.
As the court discussed, the lower court did make its decision on the rightness issue. You know, for reasons I already stated, the matter was ripe long before issue even came before the lower court, and it was ripe long before the appeal was determined. In terms of whether or not the issue was raised in the lower court, first, for reasons I already stated to you regarding the invasion of privacy, I do believe that the pleadings under 12b-6 did set forth the cause of action. There was also causes of...
Specifically how you pled invasion of privacy.
How specifically?
Yes.
This is at detail in my reply brief, so I could tell you to consult that if you'd like at a later time. The nature of the intrusion was described. The nature of the intrusion being the forgery, the intentional, it's an intentional act, solitude or seclusion of another, accessing protected health information, sensitive health information.
It said that in the complaint.
It said it in, I believe it did say it in the complaint, Your Honor.
You used those exact words, solitary and...
I'll tell you what.
Okay, well, I'll look at it later, that's all right.
I think it's the second amended complaint.
This is the second amended complaint, correct.
Correct.
Purposely altered, forged, to gain access to, quote, private health information. And the second amended complaint also stated invasion of privacy, and quote, that the extent of the interference with appellant's rights was to such a degree as to have seriously interfered with plaintiff's right to privacy. The third element of intrusion upon seclusion being highly offensive to a reasonable person. That is a question of degree. And I believe that's the language I just stated, that it was quoted enough. And let's not forget the causes of action for fraud and the breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, both of which the damages that were pled in the complaint, severe emotional distress, along with the tort of intentional infliction of emotional distress.
What's your position on whether or not we should address anything in this case other than the fact that, other than whether Judge Denton was correct in his determination as to rightness, as to whether or not those very same issues that you were raising were part and parcel of the appeal in the other case?
Well, I'll be honest, I'm a little bit torn because on the one hand, I want the case to be remanded and proceed in the district court. On the other hand, I don't want to be right back in front of you in another year asking, you know, whether or not these claims constitute a sufficient cause of action. To conclude, I'll state in conclusion, Your Honor, is that this type of matter, this type of action, this type of conduct, to simply be waived off with impunity and to be jumped out of the procedural loopholes, none of which I think Appelli is cinched tightly enough. But I think that this is a matter that needs to be addressed by the Supreme Court. And in light of that, I guess I wouldn't be opposed to a de novo review.
One last question.
Sure.
Considering the outrage here and about the forgery, was there any reference to the state bar on that conduct?
There was no reference to the state bar that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
No request down below in the trial court?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Allen, Mr. Gannon, we thank you for the arguments today. This matter stands adjourned. We will recess and call the court tomorrow morning.